Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TakeCast, now a part of the Fantasy Radio Network. This episode is the part three of the ongoing series with Frisco Josh Hermsmeyer, about his statistical work in the NFL community, some of the lessons that he's learned in 2018, some of the new things that his research is teaching us about the game of football, as well as some rookie quarterback conversation, a little bit of DFS chatter, and of course at the end we had to get some sous vide takes from Mr. Fine Dining himself. A really good and enjoyable episode, and after a quick advertisement, we will get right into it. Of course, I always need to remind you guys to leave a rating and review on iTunes. That is most helpful. And also, if you feel like extra supporting the show, you can sign up for the Patreon for $5 a month. You get bonus episodes of the show, slate-specific breakdowns for all of the DraftKings showdown slates for the NFL games, including all these playoff games where we're going to have absolutely massive prize pools coming out. And it's really helpful. We have a Discord going now for all the subscribers, which is basically like a Slack chat. Everyone just hangs out in there, talks NFL, talks DFS, talk strategy. We talked some cooking in there the other day. You guys know how these things go. And let's get into it. Daily Roto is a mostly proud sponsor of the TakeCast, a mostly sports podcast. TakeCast listeners can save 10% at Daily Roto with the promo code Janis, J-A-N-I-S. If you are playing on DraftKings or FanDuel, Daily Roto will help you improve your daily fantasy results this fall and save time in the process with lineup optimizers, ownership projections, fantasy projections, premium content, and much more. They have all the good stuff that you want to help you make money at sports betting and daily fantasy. Their new lineup optimizer will let you build optimal GPP teams with stacks based on their projections faster than I can punt money off betting on Peter Uihlein. Sure, you can play the guys that I recommend each week, but shouldn't you also get advice from a proven daily fantasy winner like Drew Dinkmeyer? Yes, I do have better hair than Drew, but I also have his cell phone number, and that makes me a winner almost as much as it makes him a winner of the DraftKings Millionaire Maker. And it's not just fantasy. They have tools to bet on player props, golf matchups, and a customizable NFL game simulator for this fall. Save 10% with promo code Janis today. All right, everyone. Welcoming back everyone's, probably favorite guest, Frisco Josh. It's between you, Pat Mayo, and Andrew Dinkmeyer. The three of you are the guys who I get requests to come back on most often.
Well, I totally understand Pat and Andrew. Like Pat is clearly the most polished of anyone that's doing online content right now. The guy is just crushes it every week and every day that he does it. And then Drew, is there a nicer guy that you've met? I don't know. That he just seems to me like salt of the earth kind of guy. You just want to hang out with as much as possible. So I totally get that.
He's a good dude. But you were a requested guest to come back on the show to really summarize the defenses don't matter season. People wanted to know, what we've learned. Has anything changed from week one to now? I mean, I will say the first 6 months of the season was just a bonanza for the don't run the football and defenses don't matter. And then scoring really trailed off second half of the season. You even admitted on Twitter that maybe the Ravens defense is good at preventing completions of passes. So you actually just had an article come out using the next gen stuff. And you wanted to talk a little bit about play action and, are there diminishing returns the more you use it, and just kind of the impact that play action has in the NFL in 2018.
Yeah, no, that just dropped about 5 minutes ago before we came on. And I'm really pumped about it because I've been wanting for the longest time, ever since I knew this data was out there, to be able to get my hands on it. And this was one of the questions top of my list. I wanted to see if, what the football guys said about play action was true, and that one of the reasons why you want to stay away from it and not overuse it is because, hey, look, these linebackers are going to eventually, and the defense in general is going to eventually catch on that you're faking them out, and you can only bluff so many times with this thing to stop working. And all the other data, the production data that we've looked at has shown that that isn't true. But we can't say for certain that it's because they aren't fooled anymore. It may just be the case that play action is a good is a good type of play to run, regardless of whether or not defenders are fooled. So there was this open question of if defenders remained fooled. And it appears, at least for middle linebackers, and I still have to do this for box safeties and outside linebackers, that it appears are not just going to drop directly into coverage on the defense that was called, to see if they actually also follow the same pattern, which is by the 11th time a team runs play action, the defense, the middle linebacker, reacts exactly the same way as he did on the first time it was called in a single game. So it doesn't appear to be this kind of diminishing returns or people kind of getting, anesthetized to the whole thing. It really is the case that it's continues to be effective.
And so do you think that if you had a talk with football guys, you know, you talk to a quality control assistant for the Tennessee Titans, and you led them, you know, you led in with this research and you were like, look, we know that this is a qualm you guys have, but the research shows there are not diminishing returns. How do you think that conversation would go?
I think he would say things like the following. Well, middle linebacker isn't always the guy we need to move, Josh. You know, we need to move this guy over here. We need to make sure this nickel linebacker is the guy, or nickel cornerback is the guy that moves. Or we need that box safety to go to the left. Or, you know, each play, each concept will have its own needs. And it may be the case that certain play action plays are less effective at getting guys that you need to move to move. And so they would probably have specific questions like that. And so then what you need is more data, and you need to more charting. You need to dig into those specific play concepts against specific defenses, and then find out the answer for them. But that's really why they should be hiring next gen researchers. That's really why every team should have an analytics department, so that they can dig in, drill down, and find out the answers to these questions for their own team, for their own set of play concepts against the defenses they expect to see. And that I hope is what, you know, this data, big data bowl, and all the rest of this stuff that the NFL's data initiatives, I hope that pushes forward this idea throughout the NFL and throughout the teams, that they should be hiring talented people, paying them reasonable amounts of money, not $35,000 a year like some slave labor. Pay them what they're worth and let them find out the answers to these questions so you can run a more efficient offense in the NFL.
And for what it's worth, I actually do think that it is trending that way. I think there's a lot of signal that we're seeing teams are, you know, they're passing more. I think the biggest signal is how often teams are going for it on fourth down now. And I believe most teams like do actually employ an analytics department now, even the Chargers.
Do you know that for a fact, the Chargers have an analytics department?
I do not know for a fact that they do, but their play style this year and overall their like play calling and roster construction leads me to believe that they have at least one guy now. I do not know that for a fact, but okay, I would lay like minus 200 they do.
I was going to actually talk with them in the offseason about helping them out, and they punted on the whole thing because of all sorts of internal strife. They have no one as of week one. So unless they added someone in season, they have no one.
Well, you should send some emails. You should reach out.
No, I don't want the job. No. This sounds like I'm jockeying for. I love working at 538, and I wouldn't want to take the pay cut to go work for a team.
No, and this is actually a great point. A lot of people on Twitter like to clap back at the analytics people, saying, well, if you were actually this good at play calling or actually this good at prospect evaluation, you just go take a job with the team making a ton of money. And people don't realize that, like, really, unless you're really established in a team, you have a very important job, you are making nothing. Like, nice. traveling scouts make less money. Like, they make like Walmart employee money.
Yep. Yeah. You could either pump gas or you could be a scout.
Yeah. And people do not think that way.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. So I tossed out in the TakeCast Discord that you were going to be coming on the show, and, you know, to ask if some people wanted questions for you. And the best one was something I'm actually super excited to hear your answer about. Do quarterbacks even matter? The top six highest paid quarterbacks are not in the playoffs. Now, part of that is, of course, juice from the fact that Brady takes a discount, though. That is one thing probably that you have to include in there, is that Brady does take a discount for the Patriots every year, and most quarterbacks do not.
Yeah, I think you know, there's a lot wrapped up in the question, do quarterbacks matter? And I'll just get it out of the way right away. Certainly, of course they matter. The passing game matters. The question is, how much do we allocate to each of the factors that contribute to a positive, successful passing game? How much credit do we give the receivers and their route running ability? How much do we give to the passer himself? How much do we give to the line? How much do we give to the play calling? And I think we all agree we give very, very little credit to the running game. So amongst those pieces, how do we apportion credit? And that is the ultimate question of football. It's, I think right now, closer to being knowable, but I think ultimately probably unknowable. And so when you see these results like we have this year where there are, lower paid quarterbacks that have made the playoffs or the highest paid quarterbacks did not make the playoffs, I think what you're seeing is the confluence of all those factors and the different ways that you can find success in the passing game and in NFL offenses, where each of those factors is weighted differently. Last year you had Case Keenum, a very average quarterback, as we saw this year, perhaps slightly below average, as his career numbers suggest.
I'm still a member of Keenum Hive. I still think provided the proper situation, he can be good.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And their team ran play action a ton last year. The Vikings did. They had amazing skill position players, didn't run very much, or at least weren't very good at it. And they were wildly successful. And I think, so it's how you put all those pieces together. And I think one other point is kind of this notion that there are system quarterbacks. I mean, it's ridiculous, in my opinion. In my view, it's absolutely ridiculous to call anyone a system quarterback. If you're any good at what you do as a quarterback, it's impossible to separate the quarterback from the system. He is a living embodiment of the system. He is a personification of the system. And so to call someone a system quarterback is really to say he's functioning at a high level. And that's great. And that's what you want. That's what everyone should be looking for. This over-reliance on traits, I think, can lead you to perhaps overpaying certain types of quarterbacks, overdrafting certain types of quarterbacks, when what you really want is a system quarterback for your system.
I would actually say that being a good system quarterback is honestly probably a compliment, because it means that you're able to successfully implement what the coach wants to do. And being able to successfully implement what a good coach wants to do is like a huge tactical advantage. Like I would say Mitch Trubisky, he's super good at the Matt Nagy offense, but if you put him in like the Green Bay McCarthy Rodgers offense, he'd be horrible. They'd lose 14 games. They just would never be any good. But Matt Nagy looks at Trubisky and says, okay, what can he do? How can I support this skill set? How can I do the things that I want to do on offense devoid of any quarterback and implement Trubisky into that? I think those two right there are like a perfect marriage of not a perfect quarterback and a good system and getting those things together to like be an above average NFL offense.
Completely agree with all that. Yep.
Does Tariq Cohen matter? I would be on board saying, actually, you know what my biggest crusade is of 2018 is that what we used to use to insult players, we used to say offensive weapon. Like we used to call like Tavon Austin that. We used to call Dexter McCluster that. That player actually has now more tactical advantage in the NFL than like at any point in the last 10 years.
Yeah, no, I think a Tariq Cohen type player, it's just really hard to get excited about him coming into the season. But then when it's proven to you game after game that Nagy's going to use him in creative ways, get him in space and game plan kind of around him as a piece, in a way that, and in an effective way, unlike what happened with Tavon Austin, unlike what they tried to do with Cordarrelle Patterson. And even I know you're a big Cordarrelle fan, but even the Patriots, I mean, haven't gotten a ton out of them. They've got more.
But that's never what they don't use that sort of player well. What the Patriots do well is they take guys who are undervalued because they can't do eight things. They take guys who are undervalued who do two things really well, and they only ever ask them to do those two things. And I actually think in 2018 that has less advantage. You want guys who can do more than one thing at a time. Like, I actually think that's a disadvantage that the Patriots have now. Like, when you look at their offense, you say, well, who's really the game-breaking guy? You know, they kind of don't really have that guy. But if they used Patterson, you know, if they use Patterson out of the backfield and as a wide receiver, like, on the same drive, like, really when Patterson comes in, he's either playing running back or he's playing wide receiver. They don't move him around. They don't use him how the Chiefs would use Tyreek Hill. Not that Patterson is that good, but he is that fast, and he's actually probably a better ball carrier than Tyreek is. There is more things that McDaniels could do with Patterson, but opts not to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think it's also installation of those plays. It's the burden overhead of actually creating them and kind of envisioning how they'll fit into your overall scheme. I do think there's an overall overhead and a burden to having certain types of players on your team. And unless you can drop them in a way that fits a piece or a wrinkle that is, you know, that also has constraint plays, that also is solid foundational football. In other words, the Wildcat went away because there was only really three plays you could run off of it. And once you figure those out as a defense, there's just nothing left to do. And so what you need is real foundational, solid, you know, fundamental football plays where you can run all sorts of different things off them, keep the offense or the defense guessing, and in that way, wrap it into your offense so that you don't actually suffer when that player comes on the field. And I think people like Cordarrelle are tougher to build that type of offense around. And I've always thought perhaps, you know, a guy in the going back to Tariq Cohen, that when Cohen comes on the field, you're giving a lot away, right? You're showing your ass and like, well, it's going to be a pass play and they're certainly not going to run him up the middle. But running up the middle is garbage anyway. So, I mean, you're
right.
Really,
so why even bother about like, oh, they know we're going to pass. I mean, is that even really that big of a tactical disadvantage? I don't think so.
Yeah. And then I think that's kind of where I'm coming down. Like, I mean, you don't want to take away the idea that you'll never run or that you'll run, you know, you don't want it to be the case that you'll never run from this formation or this personnel grouping, but it is okay if they think you're never going to run with Tariq Cohen. I mean, that's okay.
It's okay to think they'll never run up the middle with Tariq Cohen, but they still do call run plays for him.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But I just mean like, you know, that's what the jet sweep can help you do. And then, you know, you have a running play off of a look that actually goes to a receiver who's good in space or perhaps Cohen in space or whatever it might be, like you say, these outside runs. And I think you can still benefit that way without pounding it up in between the one gap and the two gap and all that crap.
So another question from the Discord. The Bears and the Ravens are making a pretty convincing argument that that defenses do hashtag matter. They've shown some ability to limit pass catching. However, I would say even before throwing this to you, the counter to that would be is that the Bears defense, which is, you know, supposedly this amazing defense, one, generated a lot of turnover luck, and two, you know, they're supposedly this great run defense, but they're really about half a yard better league average in terms of like yards per carry or whatever. So I will, with those two things in mind, I will toss over the Bears and Ravens 2018 defenses to you.
Yeah. So, let's circle back on my whole defenses doesn't matter take. First of all, it, you know, it's about fantasy. It's about offensive production, basically AYA and fantasy points are the things I looked at. I actually remove interceptions because I'm just looking at,
because interceptions, you know, are random,
you know? And so but also they're only negative 2 points in fantasy. So it's like, it's not even worth that much to consider them. And so from that perspective, the only time defense started to matter, and it was inconsistent, was in the last 4 weeks of the season. But it would go from mattering a lot, like relative to it, how it used to matter, to nothing. And so even like in those last 4 weeks, it's hit or miss. And so that continued to kind of, you know, I could show the graph again, but in those last 4 weeks, you might have like a correlation on R squared of like 0.2, which is pretty good. And then it'll go down to like negative 0.01. And that means you can't rely on defense to be a signal for how you should play your fantasy games, your DFS, who you should start. And that was my entire defense doesn't matter take. In football, as we've discussed already on this show, it matters incredibly important what the defense is doing, how they're playing you in the matchups and all the rest, because that, if you have the control over your offense, you have to call the right plays that take advantage of that defense. It's just that everyone in the NFL is competent and they do that, or at least most people, and not named Hugh Jackson, are competent and are able to find good matchups and then, you know, move away from the parts of the things that the defense is taking away. And so, yes, the Ravens defense is good. And you can even see it in the data. You can see that the Ravens defense stops completions at a higher rate, a statistically significantly higher rate, than at least two teams in the league. And I mean, that doesn't sound like much, but that's a huge deal. We can actually say the Ravens are better than two teams for sure. And you know, I mean, people roll their eyes and go, "Wow, you know, wow, you've really gone out on a limb, Josh." But it is kind of exciting to be able to say that beyond a shadow of a doubt, and so, or at least a 95% credible interval. And then as far as the Bears go, I don't know how you quantify how good they are, but they certainly cause offenses fits, and they cause them fits in a way that it makes it difficult for even highly skilled offensive coordinators and play callers to run an efficient offense against them and to score lots of points against them. And you know, that has proven to be true and became reliably true as the season went on. But it wasn't until the end of the season that it was the case. Even early in the season, teams weren't really putting up what you would consider to be abnormally low fantasy points against the Bears.
So I guess like there are two really interesting things to me about the playoffs this year, and I'm trying to keep this, you know, kind of more loosely evergreen so that we're not just talking about the wild card weekends. I actually don't know when this is coming out, but this is we are recording this the Friday before the wild card games. But the most interesting thing to me in the NFL right now is just how successful the Ravens are running the ball. And it's always kind of been my contention that if there was a quarterback that could hold up to it, that could take 20 hits a game, that like running like a spread run option offense in the NFL, if the quarterback was durable enough and fast enough, that it actually probably would work. And I mean, the Ravens, this is a crazy stat. Since Lamar took over after the bye, they have ran for more yards than they passed in all games but one. And the only reason they didn't was because Mark Andrews caught a pass and shrugged off two safeties and ran 80 yards. But other than that, it would have been more rush yards every single game. And Josh, they're winning. They have a good EPA added per play. Like they are playing good football, just owning the hell out of the libs by running the ball.
I think one of the only run that we've been able to consistently say is on a par with the average pass is the QB scramble. And I don't know how many of Lamar Miller's plays are designed runs versus scrambles. It's actually something you could find out. But I would venture to guess that a lot of that EPA came from scrambles. I do believe, though, that a guy with his skill set, that is as quick as him, you spread the other team out, and then you run with the quarterback. And as you say, if he can be legitimately healthy after a season of doing that, you know, you might stand a good shot, just like Kaepernick did against the Packers coming into the playoffs. You know, taking everyone not by surprise so much, but just it's hard to defend against. You really have to.
I think it's exhausting for defenders to defend against the Ravens right now. I just think it's probably like every play they're like. It's probably very discouraging. It's probably what all of like the you know, the football guys say, that just like lining up against a defense or an offense, knowing what they're going to do and still giving up 5 yards per play. It's got to just be terrible as a defensive player. It just has to be horrible to play against.
Yeah. And super sharp guys like Justice Mosqueda, he actually has looked at this and their offense, and he actually thinks it's novel and new, and that they're taking a lot of really good plays from the college ranks. Like from teams that, remember, he posted a thread on some of the really cool option run plays that they're doing in college, and it really blew my mind. And I think he's super excited about what they're doing in Baltimore. So I'm not chalking this up to the old NFL.
This is new stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so that, I think, is exciting. I am not anti-run. I'm just anti-bad football. And what the Baltimore Ravens have been doing these past 4 or 5 weeks has been good football.
It's been awesome to watch, and this leads to the next point of conversation. I want to talk to you about the rookie quarterbacks in general. I am higher on Lamar than I was at the beginning, just because I've seen him now come in and win games running the ball. However, I do think there is a ton of long-term concern about him, and we're seeing it. Like, we saw it with Kaepernick, we saw it. We're seeing it now with Cam Newton. His like shoulder gets injured every year because he's taking these hits. And I don't know if he has the ability to generate the accuracy that would be needed if he was going to stop running. So what are your blanket thoughts on the rookie quarterbacks, on Lamar, on Baker, kind of just on all of these guys?
probably the most fascinating thing is that Josh Allen ended up being like Cable Lamar Jackson, right? And that was probably not something anyone saw coming.
Well, not even like he wasn't doing a lot of this stuff on design runs, though. That's the thing, is that he's doing this outside of an offense that's really set up for him to succeed. He's kind of just scrambling a lot, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And then again, it goes back to that whole scrambling thing is just actually a really good play. But again, I mean, like, I think it goes back to he was overdrafted. Like, because Lamar Jackson was, what, 31st, 32nd pick? And Josh Allen was taken much, much further up than that. And I think anyone who's looked at both their games, and you can see one's in the playoffs, one's not, that's always, you know, a real dunk scoreboard kind of thing to say. But it's I do think you could see that, you know, Allen was overdrafted, and that if this is what you're going to point to and say, well, look at him, he scored 5 touchdowns, you know, and 3 of them were on the ground or whatever it was in week 17. I think you're missing the boat on what people drafted Josh Allen to be.
He wasn't drafted to be this. He did not show this running ability at Wyoming. If he had shown this running ability at Wyoming, he wouldn't have been like third team all whack. Like he would have been a Heisman candidate. Like, quarterbacks who run in college just get like such a boost of like awareness. Like Kyler Murray, great runner, right? That's like what really separated him. That's what made him different from Baker, really, at Oklahoma. And he was not this in college at all.
Yeah. And so I would say, man, you should have taken Lamar. And so that's that take on those two rookies. Baker is who we thought he was going to be.
He's so good.
You know, I think Bill Connell. I always get his name wrong.
The SB Nation guy.
SB Nation guy.
Bill Connolly.
Bill Connolly, super sharp guy, and he knows college football as well as anyone. And he's done a lot of analytical studies. And what his take is that your performance in college sets your ceiling for the pros. No one has ever done better in the pros than they did in college. It makes perfect sense. I mean, he's shown it to be true. And what we saw
in terms of quarterbacks.
Yeah, in terms of quarterbacks.
Yeah, because I was going to say there are a lot of running backs that were like horrible in college and then end up like have 1,000-yard seasons in the NFL.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm speaking about quarterbacks and so what we saw with Baker in his college performance was a guy, when you adjusted for depth of target, you saw a guy that was functional at all depths. And what does that mean? What is that actually telling us? It's not just that he's accurate, right? We knew he was accurate. It tells us that he works in the system he's asked to work in. And that is a proxy for football intelligence. And that is important because we don't have a lot of measures that can get to that, right? It's one of the biggest problems in football analysis for quarterbacks and kind of projecting them. Like, what's their football? They created an entire test to try and figure out how smart guys were and how well they could kind of, adapt to new information quickly. And so I think that's the best metric for it. And it was over the moon. I mean, it was Drew Brees good in college. And so what we saw in the NFL was he was about average. He was about average this year, a little above. And for a first-year rookie, that's an incredible thing to do. And I think the future is super bright for Baker Mayfield for all those reasons, not the least of which also is that he'll have a full season next year without Hugh Jackson. And then you have the two opposite ends. I was more, in terms of Darnold and Rosen, I was kind of more on the Rosen side. He's certainly in a – well, not certainly. He's in a worse situation with the Arizona Cardinals this year than Darnold was. But by the same token, Darnold's certainly shown more than Rosen has. Rosen has looked utterly lost this year, and he doesn't look like a guy who can transcend anything.
I got to have a mea culpa here. I did like Rosen more than Darnold before the draft, and I've definitely flip-flopped on that now.
Yeah, I don't know if I have enough to flip, but it's concerning. Like, I mean, I would love to see them put some real weapons around him and use David Johnson correctly, for God's sake. But, you know, I don't know. It's worrying because, like I say, he doesn't look like a guy who is able to transcend at all, his situation. He's not making players around him better. He's needing them to make him good, which is kind of a Case Keenum way to live in the NFL.
Yeah, I have him now 5th. Of the 4 guys, because I think they're of the 5th of the 5 guys. Like, I think that what Allen has shown is like so electrifying that if he just even generates any accuracy, I think that he will be so good. Whereas, like, I think Rosen has to do like seven things. Like, I don't even see the picture of what all pro Josh Rosen would be. I totally see it for Allen. I totally see it for Lamar. Obviously see it with Baker. And then Darnold, I think Darnold's career, I think this coaching hire is so crucial to what Darnold will be. If they hire someone bad, if they hire Mike McCarthy, or if they hire someone that's going to get fired this time next year, I mean, it honestly could be curtains for Darnold because he just won't take that developmental step. But if they hire Todd Monken, if they hire someone good, yeah, I think like Darnold could be one of the best 12 quarterbacks in the NFL.
Yeah, and one thing I would say is like Kevin Cole has done a lot of work on the career paths of young quarterbacks, and by the end of the second year, you have a really strong idea. By the end of the first, you really don't. So I would hold out hope on Rosen. I wouldn't close the book on him. Obviously, I mean, have your relative rankings, whatever. I mean, that's always fun, but
just you know, here for the clicks, Josh.
Yeah, right. I do feel like there's still hope for Rosen.
I mean, I went back. I did this. I just went back and looked because I wondered, you know, in the Saquon Darnold debate. And I just went back and looked at some of the rookie seasons of, like, guys who are still playing, like, good elite NFL quarterbacks. There are some just really bad rookie seasons for guys that you think of as being very good now. Like, Eli Manning's been a starter in the NFL for, like, 15 years, and he had a 3.5 adjusted yards per attempt, like, his first season. Rivers was just okay. Brady was just okay. Manning was, I believe Manning had more interceptions than touchdown passes, even though he threw 25 touchdowns. Or maybe it was Luck that had more interceptions than touchdowns. But there are a lot of guys who were not good as rookies.
Yeah, it's insane. And there's a lot of chicken or the egg stuff there. It's like people like to point out, well, if you're an early round draft pick, it means you're probably good or you have talent. But it also means you're probably going to a shitty team. So. I don't know. The Arizona Cardinals, I thought were going to be better than they were this year. I think by week one, all of that, we're disabused of that idea.
Yeah. I obviously thought that the Cardinals were going to be a lot better than they were. Cause I was very high on David Johnson for fantasy.
I was going to stake you on that one.
Ooh, boy, that didn't
go through.
Yeah. That was pretty bad. Okay. So what is something that you've learned this year that has changed your viewpoint about projecting football or about building models? Or was there anything? Has your view stayed static? Has the process stayed the same? Have you learned anything from Kelvin Benjamin in terms of building models?
Yeah, so I will go back and look at all of the data at the end of the year here in the off season, and that's when I'll really kind of tease out any new learnings that there might be. At this point, what I saw this year was, in general, the models that I rely on did a decent job. They had their failings like they always will. They had their successes, some wild successes, which could just as easily be variance, or it could be, you know, proof that the model is actually really good. So over the long run, it's been good, and that's what I look at. The back testing, which I already do, would make me have faith in the model in the first place, shows it's good. So I'm very circumspect when people, you know, ask, well, looking back on the year, is there anything you would change, or are you worried about, you know, redacted Benjamin? Like, did he show the model was broken? I don't think it's true. I think every year we see some guys like that. I mean, after all, things like air yards model or the other things I do, I'm looking for guys in a pool of players that you would expect to be bad and or expect to do worse than the rest of the population of players. And it regularly turns out that millionaire maker winners come out of that pool of players. And so that is evidence enough to me that we're looking in the right place, and that our previous show about, you know, trying to time the market is actually the way to go when you're playing a game like fantasy that we do.
Okay. I would like to argue with you about one thing, though. Jarvis Landry and what he offers on a football field, I refuse to believe that he is hashtag good or a plus EV player, because I think the thing that he does that is demonstrably good, demonstrably better than other players, it like convinces coaches to call minus EV plays.
Every pass play is a plus EV play.
But okay. Even if I granted that, which I guess that I probably would, my counterpoint to that would be, just because something is plus EV doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing something that is more plus EV, right? That would be right. That would be the counterpoint to the Jarvis Landry thing.
And this is where I kind of take the point of view that, well, let's get the NFL doing the right thing more often than not, and then we can argue about profit maximization or optimization. You know, let's first at least say, well, they're running less and throwing short to Jarvis Landry, and that is a trade-off I'd be happy to see happen. You know, and if it takes baby steps for teams to learn that, you know, taking those deep shots are a lot like three-point plays where you don't complete them as often, but when you do, you change the game in a really powerful way. And so you should take more of them. You know, I think that is something that's going to come very, very late in the process and very, very late in the evolution of the NFL, where it's not just taking the three deep shots a game, where it's 10 deep shots a game, you know, where it's, you know, a big part of your passing offense is actually trying to get those high variance, high upside plays. And then you would be able to make the case that, yeah, Jarvis Landry is losing value.
I should even scale it back a little bit further. Jarvis Landry is minus EV at 160 targets a year. At like 95 targets a year, I think he would be like the GOAT.
Oh, okay. So you just don't like the volume. Well,
it's just again, like he catches such – okay. So like what he is very good at, or at least he has at Bennett sometimes, at some points of this year, he was horrible at converting his targets into catches. But obviously converting a target into a catch at above a league average rate over like, you know, a long enough sample, that's definitely a good skill to have. You want to be completing more passes than you are incompleting. What I think Landry does to a coaching staff is it lulls them into like this false sense of security that like gaining 7 yards a clip, which like certainly is good. You want to be doing that, but like, I don't know, isn't like an 18 yard target to Antonio Callaway that's completed at like 56% of the time, isn't that a better play than 7 yards to Landry at 70% completion? Like, I don't know. I'm asking, you know the math, so I'm asking you.
Well, it's that balance between staying on schedule and trying to get more yards on. And again, if those throws are coming at the expense of runs or swing passes that are like, you know, a depth of target of half a yard, like give me Landry. So I don't understand, you know, because you're comparing him to his peers and doing it by yards per attempt or whatever it might be, yards per target. He comes out looking poorly, but when you look at him from a depth of target perspective with Racer, he's extremely efficient. Where's the truth lie? Well, the truth lies probably in EPA, and in EPA, he is still positive value. He's a positive value player. And so I don't get it. You know, yeah, perhaps teams should be taking more shots downfield, as I said, but I would much rather them take their volume of plays directed towards a short slot wide receiver, low eight out wide receiver, and pump the volume in there. But again, that's not what he was this year. This year, he was like a 10 A-dot guy. He was like AB. He was like Antonio Brown. And his efficiency suffered because of that. But his yards per target is up slightly. And he actually made some big plays. I remember at the beginning of the season, he made an incredible one-handed catch. And I think he bookended the season with another really good play in the end zone from Baker Mayfield, which, you know, the people who don't like Landry throw shade on it and say, well, he was completely covered. Still caught the damn ball, still got the touchdown. And I think he's a player who can continue to make those plays.
Jarvis Landry is not, he's not bad, right? Like he's not a player that like you put out there and you're losing expected points. I just think that he's like, I think that he just kind of, I do. I think he forces coaches to do some things that are less valuable than other things could be. And I think part of that is minimized in Cleveland because the other pass catchers were not very good. But I think, like, for example, if he was playing with, like, if Antonio Callaway was really good, like if we considered Antonio Callaway a top 20 talent and he was getting less deep targets because they were throwing 7 yard slant routes to Landry, I think it would be like more of a legitimate argument.
I mean, I guess there's something to be said for it. When him and Odell were both at LSU, they kind of split the targets, and it certainly seems
Landry was a better prospect than Odell Beckham.
It certainly seems to be the case that you would want to be throwing more to Odell in that situation. But maybe there's something else that we're not seeing here, because, again, targets are a measure of talent, and it's not empty volume. if you earn a target, it means you earned it. And so there's something about his game that forces teams to throw at him. He's not like their only last best hope. I mean, I don't know. I guess I just come down to, I think he's better than all you guys are willing to grant him. And I think the shade comes from really weird places, like, you know, overuse of a single metric like yards per target.
I think all of the shade just comes from the fact that, like, I think a lot of the shade comes from the fact that he was just a super annoying player to own in DFS this year. He was horribly annoying.
Like Julio. Like Julio last year.
No. Nothing like Julio. Like Julio's bad games are like 9 receptions for 85 yards. A bad Jarvis Landry game this year was like 11 targets, 3 receptions, 47 yards.
Julio had, I think, 3 games last year of 5 points or less. People were apoplectic. I mean, there's a reason why I started never Julio. People would get up in my mentions with like crazy talk. Like, I'm never drafting Julio again. He has ruined my team. He's just the worst receiver in football. Most overrated player ever. Like, it just, people get emotional about this shit. Yes, Landry had a disappointing season, but he's coming off a year where he had 9 touchdowns. I mean, of course he was going to regress there.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. The thing I wanted to close on was I've been getting pretty into food these days, like trying to learn how to cook, trying to learn how to create some fine dining experiences at home. And I know you, as a man of class, you will have some things for me. Other than first, I would love for you to talk about the sous vide, and then this is your floor to give out one other fine dining, you know, cookery tip to the TakeCast listeners.
Wow!
Elevate the discussion.
Yeah. So sous vide, for those who don't know, is basically just cooking in a water bath, and it's precisely temperature controlled water bath. You stick one of these sticks in it, basically a recirculator, takes the water in one end and spits it out the other, and heats the water in the middle. And then after about, you know, 5 minutes, the water is at a perfect temperature, and then it's kept there. And so you put something in a bag, and then you throw it in the water, and 45 minutes, hour and a half, 2 hours a day, 24 hours later, you have a perfectly cooked piece of meat or egg or custard or even vegetables, and you get it perfect, and you can't overcook it, and you take it out and you sear it, and you have a perfectly cooked piece of meat. So what is good about it? First of all, if you're on the go or you don't have a lot of room in your kitchen and you don't have a lot of time, you're going to work, you just throw it in there, you come back home and you take it out, sear it up, and your meat and your food is ready to go. So it saves you time. It saves you money because you're not screwing up. You know, there's no overdone stuff. Everything's good. Your family likes the food no matter what, because it's cooked exactly how they like it.
Is it true that you can't overcook it in the sous vide at all?
No, you really can't. I mean, you would have to leave it in there for days.
I had no idea. I had no idea that was one of the advantages. That's a pretty cool advantage.
It's a huge advantage. I mean, there are things that can happen to the texture of the meat. The collagen eventually breaks down over time. And so, you know, kind of like if you're doing a crock pot cook or whatever, you put in like a braising something, you know, eventually the meat becomes like collagen, you know, it melts and you get a soft meat, like a roast. So you can get that with sous vide, but it's typically not what you want to do with like a nice steak or something. You know, you only want it to get cooked. So anyway, that's the overall benefit of sous vide, is those two things. It saves you time, in terms of, you don't have to be attentive. It can, you set it and forget it. And then the other part of it is that you don't screw up. And so it allows you time to do other things, like, you know, make your side dish, or not make a side dish, just save time in general. And that's really why I like sous vide so much, is because you can make a really delicious food and it takes all the guesswork out.
I'm in. I'm sold. I gotta get one. $120. Oh, that's nothing. I actually just bought a food processor. I tried to make parsnip puree the other night, and I learned parsnips are gross. I don't want to eat those. That's disgusting.
Need lots of butter in there to kind of cut that.
I never had parsnips before, but I like watch these cooking shows, right? And one of the things they always make with a white meat dish is they always have a parsnip puree like on the plate, right? To like offer like some contrasting flavor, but it's horrible. It's disgusting.
For purees, I really like broccoli and cauliflower. And all you do is steam them, and then you put them in that processor and with butter and salt, and then you put your meat on top of that or whatever protein you got, and that is a solid dish. Because it pairs so well with the meat. Really good stuff.
Recommend to me a vegetable that I probably have not eaten that I should go out of my way to try and eat.
A vegetable.
I'm just trying to add some more nutrition into my diet in 2019. Like I take a multivitamin, I do what I need to do, but there's no real substitute for getting that actual like vitamin earthy substance that you get from plants. I think that anyway.
My favorite is like eggplant curry. Like I could eat that all day.
I do love curry.
So like get some boxed curry, test them out, find which one you like the best. You really don't need to go crazy, like make your own. Get some boxed curry and then just slice up some eggplant, like kind of thick, and then cook it in the curry, and it's amazing. It's amazing. And yeah, add some other stuff too. But that I would do that, some rice on the side, that'd be money.
All right. Oh, man. There we go. We've had it. That was fine dining with Frisco Josh. Tell people about the 538 gig and where to find all your current work.
Yeah, 538 is where I'll be writing about real football for the foreseeable future. And I just finished up at 444 and I might be back there next year, hopefully, and with the air yards model. I did have to wrap that up. It just didn't work anymore for the playoffs. I tried to run it and the thing just didn't work. Yeah, I'm on my own in the playoffs. I did notice, for those of you who are looking, the things that you would expect to be predictive of performance in the playoffs, the standard things are essentially the most important. Air yards and target share and all that stuff becomes far less important than the things you would expect, like yards per game and even touchdowns, total touchdowns. So I would just play it straight. I don't think teams are going to veer too much from what got them in the playoffs in terms of receivers.
All right, there we go. That's all good and helpful stuff as always from Josh. Thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thanks, man.